Come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network, WPRPN. Live streaming today from under a Byzantine matrix of heavily clouded South Korean skies, you're listening to episode 64 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. What sort of show can listeners expect this week? Take your best guess. For anyone following the June schedule, you'll know we were hoping to present our 2017 John Ford UFO Political Prisoner Roundtable. Last year's event came off quite well, and we were aiming to take things even further this time around. However, as with all too many shows here via the Robin Hood, as of late, things are still pretty much up in the air. Anyone familiar with John's case will know how, over the past 21 some odd years, he's found himself quietly warehoused in a New York State psychiatric institute for the criminally insane. All for what? Mass murder? Serial rape? War crimes which left millions of helpless brown-skinned people homeless and dead in the Middle East? Not even close. The best load of nonsense Suffolk County's slimy state prosecution was ever able to cook up is the as-of-yet still wholly unsubstantiated charge of attempted political assassination via hypothetical exposure to a potentially non-lethal dose of radioactive toothpaste. Yes, it would be quite laughable if it all just wasn't so fucking sad. Speaking of laughable, that was quite the start we had to today's show. I think we've managed to get things more or less straightened out. Poor Joe Eminon there doing his best to keep
live
things
streaming today
together
under a Byzantine matrix.
You're listening to episode 64. So it's just been one technical issue after another. We'll work things out though later in post production. Joe, did you manage to make it? I think we had you here. Saw you out in the docks trying to do your best to make an appearance. So how are things going? Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, fine. You're coming in loud and clear, better than a phone call.
Excellent. Well, let's hope that your end of things manages to hold up today and we can somehow manage to, make our way through what so far has been a totally less than stellar start to things. But who knows? We'll see how things unfold over the next hour and a half. Together, the two of us, we're working on inviting a number of people that we had join us last year. Of course, we had a great show that we put together with the roundtable that we did manage to do. It's about a year ago now, in fact, last June. So, and that marked the 20th year anniversary. You betcha. So Marilyn Carlson, I guess she's off on a cruise in Alaska, presumably with her husband. You contacted Ken Storch, who I guess he's part of the Inception Radio Network. It's a monthly kind of deal is what you guys are running over there. I think you frequently make an appearance, try to every month talking about John's case. Who else did we have? Kelly Freeman, of course, and Richard Smith hopefully is going to pop in. What's his schedule like today? He's got something else on the go, unfortunately. He's kind of double booked. What's the deal there?
He has to work until midnight his time, and he's in New Mexico, but he was going to attempt to get some time off to be on this particular show. Ken Storch isn't associated with Inception Radio Network. He's an independent investigator, a former law enforcement officer. He's retired, and he's very much like John Ford. He's just a regular on the show, as are Marilyn and Dick Carlson and Peter Moon. Peter is, I guess, he said that he was looking forward to it, and if he's around, if you want to drag him into the Skype line, you know, I'm sure he's prepared and so forth. He's a good speaker. And we've been running the show on Inception Radio Network every month, the second Sunday of every month. So over 2 years now, we've been running the show. It's been one hassle after another, technically, because people have been getting all sorts of, it's not just technical issues. I mean, it's flat out sabotage to keep the word from getting out. You can hear it in the quality of the recent shows, including last month's show, which never even went off.
What happened?
Shows before that.
I'm sorry, what happened?
Last month's show didn't happen. It was supposed to be the second Sunday, which was, I believe, Mother's Day, and nobody could connect. It was shut down. In fact, I had three different levels of communication so that I'd be able to be on the show tonight, and all but one. The one that I like least is the one that I'm speaking to you on right now. That's why I wasn't able to go do things in the crow's nest, check out the YouTube channel, etc. Because I can only do this one thing, you know, just a voice, and I can see your text. I can't reply to them. I'm at the bottom level technology-wise, and I have all sorts of sophisticated equipment. So whatever they're doing is by intent, okay? And I'm not talking about the people that are on the show. I'm talking about the people that have illegally incarcerated John Ford for the last 21 years. And the anniversary was June 6th, just a few days ago.
That's right, which also happens to be the anniversary date for the invasion of Normandy, D-Day. There's a lot of talk about that in the news.
Isn't it?
So,
yeah.
How about that?
Amazing coincidence.
Well, yeah. How about that? Well, you know, we're going to forge ahead here and just kind of make our way into to the Howling Wolf Inn and make ourselves at home here, see if we can get our hands on a frosty grog, kind of relax and settle in for just hopefully, you know, decent quality conversation. You, of course, are John's power of attorney. You hold that, I'm not sure what you would say, the status or the legal authority. So, you know, and you're well, you know, clearly well-informed and up to speed. You know all the particulars, the ins and outs, and every little last detail that one could possibly imagine. So, but let's just for people, why don't we just, if we could, Joe, I think this would be a great place to start, because a lot of people out there listening have no idea, really, as to what this is all about. Who is John Ford? I think is the best place to kind of dive into things. Let's just lay that out there for people. Who was John Ford up to the date and time, the day where he was arrested? Give us a little bit of a backstory on John, if you would.
Okay, John is, he's now, I believe, 69. I believe he was 48 at the time. He was a very conservative, very righteous person. He started his career with a degree in, I believe a master's degree in law from a state university. He went to work for the court system for the New York State Supreme Court. Or Superior Court, whatever they call it, originally in Brooklyn and then out here on Long Island in Riverhead. And he had been working for the court system as a uniformed court officer, kind of like a bailiff, handling prisoners and so forth. He had to carry a gun every day for about 22 years. And he was out on disability for a short period of time before his illegal arrest and incarceration. He was running the Long Island UFO Network, an independent, not-for-profit organization registered in the state of New York. He was used as a scapegoat for criminal political activity committed by members of the political community on Long Island. And basically railroaded into a psychiatric facility as a delusional behavior or whatever. He was initially accused of conspiring to murder three people in the Suffolk County government, allegedly with radium ore, which was not in his possession. There was an illegal wiretap, and other people in the house were recorded talking about, well, why don't you take some of that radium and put it in their toothpaste, and that they actually sold this to the public, basically using the media, because Long Island is like a little country of its own. The cable company is owned by the politicians, the primary shareholders, and the main news station for Long Island and the Long Island area, you know, other than New York City, because we're east of New York City, and they go by the party line. They do what they're told. In fact, they were on the scene at John's house before his arrest. He saw a need for, because of the UFO activity on Long Island in the late 70s, early 80s, he started a group called Long Island UFO Network and registered it as a not-for-profit corporation. And he ran it out of his house, a little over 1,000 members. He was set up to investigate and ascertain whether or not a UFO was real, if somebody was seeing an aircraft or a star or a, you know, some sort of natural event or whatever. Because he believed in UFOs and he was promoting that agenda, I guess that was one of the reasons. I'm just presuming that was an important reason for his adversaries, political adversaries, to go after him. And the fact that he died of cancer, that he had a pretty big following, and that he was going to be, he was actually asked to run for state senate in New York on a conservative ticket. Okay, so we're not talking about a wackaloon, left-wing, radical, you know, long-haired hippie-type guy. We're talking about a straight-laced, uniform court officer for the New York State Supreme Court in Riverhead, basically the county seat in Suffolk County, New York, being arrested for allegedly plotting to commit murder with the ore of a radioactive element, which was not in his possession. He's been illegally incarcerated and is currently in the Mid-Hudson Forensic Psychiatric Center, which is off of Long Island, upstate New York. I think it's New Hampton, New York. It's north of New York City, about 80 miles north of New York City.
Mid-Hudson Psychiatric Institute, I think
Mid-Hudson Forensic Psychiatric Center.
They've changed the name in the last few years from, it was for the Psychiatric Institute for the Criminally Insane, and now they've changed to the Forensic Institute. I'm a little more of an Orwellian kind of euphemism, I guess. John's criminally insane, then, is he?
Well, no, he's actually not. He's probably more in his right mind than most of the people that called up his UFO hotline. He was told by his then attorney. He got a judgeship out of the Patron case.
That's John Rouse was the guy's name. John Rouse, is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. By the way, in 2002 or 2003, he was arrested also.
That was his first court-appointed lawyer, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and John Rouse, and then John Powell, who we'll get into and maybe talk about a little later here, now presently deceased, but he also ended up behind bars. This is one of the alleged targets of this conspiratorial plot, which, oh, geez. Like I said in the introduction, it would be quite laughable if it all just wasn't so fucking sad.
I just want to make one thing completely clear, that John never was a risk to himself or to anyone else. He's never been diminished capacity, or it's not a case where he didn't understand what he was being charged with. He was urged to plead guilty by reason of insanity to the three counts of conspiracy, which is all they had. And conspiracy is extremely difficult to prove unless you're on Long Island in Suffolk County, in which case it's thoroughly proved. So, he, being a state employee, They told him that he would be out in anywhere from 3 months to 3 years. They just had to make it quiet down and get him out of the limelight. So he agreed to go there, accept a plea of non-compensation in order to keep his safe pension. And that was really the driving force behind it. Because if he had been convicted of even the most minor of crime, he would not have been able to collect his state pension, which was approximately 2/3 of his salary. And he's been collecting that every month.
Yeah, the pension, that was really the kind of what essentially kind of swayed his thinking and made him decide that it would be a good idea to take the deal that I guess they were offering, really, that they're presenting to him. That, and, you know, he didn't want to lose his house. He had a couple pets, I believe, at the time, too, a few dogs that he cared for and loved greatly. Wow. He was all whacked out on LSD at the time, too. I guess somebody slipped him a dose of acid just to kind of really make it look a little more convincing, as if he truly was off his rocker. Is that not the case?
That's a story in and of itself. One of the people that was involved in this was a direct employee of the Department of Defense. At the Bremen plant where they x-ray the airframe structures on F-14s. And at the time, the F-14 program was going to be closing down. They were going to be selling the planes and so forth to other countries. The Navy never resurrected the contract, and Grumman Corporation was being bought out by Northrop. They did use radium there. The guy who was associated, well, he was employed with the Department of Defense. John had been found to be responsible and able to stand trial after being examined up there. So they sent him back, and they sent him back again instead of for a couple of weeks. This time it was for a couple of months. And they sent him back again, claiming that there was nothing wrong with him, which he had been saying all along. And then the third time, he was examined by three psychiatrists, and the idea behind it was to make sure that he was distracted and acted edgy and nervous and would repeat himself and so forth. He was very low dose of a hallucination. And that made the psychiatrist render the determination, which is non-compos mentis. And then in
plain English terms, Joe, plain English terms, that would be a plea of mental incompetency?
Right. Mental incompetence or insanity, you know.
Unfit to stand trial.
Exactly. You wouldn't understand the trial. You wouldn't understand what he's being charged with. The only remedy that the state has in those cases is to commit him as a ward of the state for psychiatric treatment. Since February of 2000, he has been in the permanent residence of the Mid-Hudson Forensic Psychiatric Facility in New Hampton, New York. And we've been trying to find some type of legal remedy for John because they're not doing anything for him and they're not letting him out. And there's nothing wrong with him. This has been established by multiple outside people, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists. He's had a number of attorneys. Basically, when the money runs out, he has to wait, and he's only allowed to file for release every 2 years. They have a retention order. They file a retention order with the state of New York. It goes in front of a judge. At that point, John contests the retention order, and the onus of innocence or guilt rests with him at that point. It's a matter of he has to prove to them he's not a risk to himself or others and engage type of behavior that they're alleging.
How is he to this point shown that he is a risk or a threat to either his own safety and well-being or that of others? I don't quite understand. It's not registering with me here at all.
That's a good point, Jeff. I'm glad you broke that up. What they're doing is basically, since he's been up there, they're collecting his Social Security disability and Medicaid federal payments through the state, approximately $300 a month. You know, in addition to whatever the state pays to maintain a mental patient in the, in a dormitory and so forth. He never had so much as a parking ticket. He's never been arrested for anything. He owned firearms.
He carried a firearm to work every single day for 22 years, every single work day. All right. He had a great employment record working in the court, handling prisoners. He didn't have any reprimands, official or otherwise, on his record. He doesn't even curse. Okay. People that see him, run into him and casually talk to him, think he's a member of the staff. The only reason they're keeping him there is because of legal issues that would allow him to file court actions against the County of Suffolk, the State of New York, and the certain psychiatrists that rendered opinions on him without ever hearing the facts and circumstances surrounding the incident of offense, which there was no incident defense.
Things most recently came to the point where he had a new legal representative supposedly in his corner going to bat for John, and had really, you know, in true con man fashion, because he really built up John's confidence. And this is an individual by the name of Robert Reno. I guess that's pretty much public record. 322 whatever street that is, and it's interesting to note the address. It could just be a coincidence, but everyone that's studied any parapolitical conspiracy type topics and looked into these issues on a wide range knows that 322, that's the Skull and Bones calling card. So it could just be
interesting,
well, you know, Trump's son-in-law, who, what is it, 666? You know, that's a big kind of deal that everyone's talking about and is out there in the public eye.
We're not even certain that Jared can speak. I've never heard him speak.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Isn't that something? Yeah, so, but let's not get sidetracked with all that kind of, that sort of thing. So, although this is interesting, speaking of the president and so forth, you know, one of the ideas and possibilities, things that I had in mind last go around as we tackled this in 2016 was a presidential pardon. So, I mean, as much as I know you personally disdain this man you refer to as the Orange Hitler, just think of it. Wouldn't it be something if he pardoned, somehow was able to flex a little political muscle and, you know, say, you know, look into the case, have us drawn to his attention, say, you know, you're right, this is a total travesty, and work to do all that he could to have him released. So it's just, you know, it could be total pie in the sky. No pun intended. It's within the realm of possibility. So let's just set that aside for the moment and take a look at, once again, going back to Mr. Robert Reno. He really pissed in the pickles, didn't he? He really kind of stabbed John in the back, really, is what it seems. Him and these assessors were expected to be in attendance to assess John's mental state and condition, that they never even showed up recently to what was slated to be a big kind of deal, a major kind of hearing. Even you yourself, you were just on your way out the door and suddenly the phone rang. Why don't you share with listeners what happened at that point of things?
Back in November, John was supposed to go for his objection for the retention hearing. In other words, they could keep him there for another 2 years. I was going to testify with regard to John's character and, more importantly, to the fact that the prosecution not only didn't offer all of the exculpatory evidence in his case, they modified and manufactured evidence in order to get a warrant, which they didn't even get until 2 days after his arrest. In other words, they had no warrant. They had no cause to be in his house.
It was illegal. That is totally illegal. How they managed to get away with that, I have no idea. You can't raid and storm somebody's house, searching through their private effects and letters without a warrant. They did that 2 days ahead of, it's like, that's totally illegal. How was this not thrown out of court?
It wasn't brought up by his attorney.
And once again, there was no habeas corpus. This is key. You know about habeas corpus, don't you?
Well, yeah, but in psychiatric cases, once you're in the psychiatric system, even a presidential pardon won't get you out.
And habeas corpus no longer applies. That's why they pushed for this, and they suckered him in, and basically they've essentially thrown away the key on the guy.
Well, habeas corpus to some extent does extend to mental health cases in rare instances if it's going through a federal jurisdiction. It would have to be brought to the federal level. And John Rouse, who was on the show that I spoke about on Inception Radio Network, in fact, the next show is this coming Sunday, if anyone wants to tune in. We have usually more people than me. In fact, I wasn't on the last show. The habeas corpus was basically thrown out as a pie in the sky type of a deal, that it would take too long. And this was by Mr. Reno himself on a live show, on a live broadcast of that particular show. And he was saying, no, if we just, play by the rules, there's obviously nothing wrong with John. He said that if John and I were walking down the street in New York City, people would look at me 10 times before they looked at him once. That's how sane he is. There's no doubt about his sanity, about his level-headedness. He said the best thing to do is just play by the system.
Yeah, right.
And his corpus would be a long route, and that was over 2 years ago. Now, just recently, I was on my way out the door to go and testify to the fact that they altered a recording not between John and the district attorney's office, but between his co-defendant, a multiple felon by the name of Joseph Massicelli, okay, who stole guns from John's gun collection and attempted to sell them, all right?
I think this is something that's important to draw to people's attention, Joe. There were, in fact, 3 people involved in this alleged conspiracy. 2 of them got much lighter sentences, treated with far more the kind of kid glove approach. I'm not sure where Joseph Massicelli is at this moment in time, although he only got a few years in prison, from what I understand. There was a third character, Mr. Zebo or Zebo, and I mean, you talked about
Zebo. He was the Defense Department employee.
And you talk about a wild-eyed. You look at the pictures that are in the that they had of him in the newspaper cutouts, and the guy looked. You're talking about kind of assessing or weighing someone's mental state by giving them a looking over. And holy geez, this guy did not look too well at all. A very crazed, kind of wild-eyed look on the man.
Anybody that works, that has ever worked or works for the Department of Defense, you can't be all there to begin with, okay? I can speak from personal experience on that. But Zabo was basically released. They needed to find more than 2 people involved in the conspiracy. 2 people alone can be considered a conspiracy. And it was John and Joe Massicelli who were charged with conspiracy, 3 counts, 1 for each of the alleged people, their alleged intended victims. And Joe Massicelli pled guilty, no contest. But they offered him a way out. They said that if he, in Joe's defense, Joe is a childhood friend from junior high school, all right? He wasn't a regular acquaintance of mine. He wasn't a close friend. But he did have some passing interest in UFOs, and he had trouble. And I figured, okay, well, John is a, very righteous person. He's not going to let him do anything wrong, et cetera. And Joe, he's actually very intelligent, although when he speaks, he sounds like a cross between a gangster and a dummy, but he can beat me in a game of chess, okay, let me put it that way. If he put his mind to it, he could probably do anything. He was offered immunity. Actually, he would be convicted and it would be time served and he would have to report to a parole officer and so forth. If he passed the plea against John, if he signed a paper saying that, yes, John conspired with him to have these people done away with by use of completely harmless. Right?
Oh, jeez. So he threw him under the bus is what happened then. I guess that's...
No. Joe refused to sign any papers. He refused to testify against John. He was convicted without a trial and given a 12-year prison sentence, of which he served 5.5 to 6 years, I believe it was.
Jeez.
And then he was on parole for another 5 years after that. Every day he had a report to a parole officer.
Now, Joseph Massicelli did have quite an extensive petty criminal record, correct?
Wasn't as extensive. When you first listened to the, I guess you heard some of the News 12 reports that I documented.
Yeah, that's great stuff, Joe. You got some great stuff archived there up on YouTube. We really want to share that with people. Let them look into it themselves. It's historic what you've archived there.
absolutely. But what I'm saying is, at one point, they said that he was arrested 50 times or something like that. He was convicted of 50 different things. No, he was arrested 5 times. He was convicted of 2 misdemeanors and 1 felony because a stove he was disposing of, and he was being paid to do this, was worth $1,100, and anything over $1,000 is considered a felony theft. He was working with a crew to clean out houses that were being sold. At the time, it was the housing market. People were buying and selling homes. It was an old gas stove, and so he spent, I think, about 2 years in a state prison in upstate New York. And John was very well aware of his criminal background and his history and so forth. The moment John found out that one of his guns were missing, he didn't want to get Mazzucchelli in trouble because he would have definitely gone to jail. So he tried to do the guy a favor. He said, look, bring it back in a day. If it hasn't been fired, we'll let bygones be bygones. But if you ever do that again, okay, and if I don't get it back in 24 hours, I'm going to call up, report it stolen. All right? And at the time, Joe Mazzucchelli was attempting to convince John Ford that he was involved with Israeli intelligence, and that Israeli intelligence was interested in UFOs, and they wanted to, quote-unquote, blow the lid off of UFO activity on Long Island, and they wanted to use John to do it and so forth. And see, he somehow convinced John, and John was in a very fragile state at the time. His mother had passed away the same year, 1996. So he was suffering from, I wouldn't say depression, but he was in mourning, and he had injured himself on the job by lifting a box of papers, of all things, and he blew out a disc in his back. Extremely painful. So he was out on disability, and he was in a lot of pain. And he had Joe Mazzucchelli telling him that people were after him, that he would protect them, all this other kind of stuff. And the radium came into play, the radium ore, okay, came into play when John ordered a very, very small amount of radium because he purchased some Geiger counters, which are used by UFO researchers to test for radiation.
Radium is a standard substance used by ufologists to help calibrate their Geiger counters, correct?
Exactly. And in fact, I instructed him how to get it legally and what to do with it. To use a piece of duct tape, you know, hit it with some sandpaper, get a little bit of it, stick it on the side of the Geiger counter, and use it to test a dosimeter. And make sure that it just goes above background radiation.
And there's no way in hell, there's no way that this is going to kill anybody unless it is consumed in just the most ridiculous amounts, correct?
You could eat a hamburger made of this stuff and you wouldn't even notice it, okay? It's not something that glows in the dark. In fact, everybody in America, everybody in the civilized world has at least one smog detector in their home. There's arsenium in there to produce particles that hit a photo detector. And if smoke blocks, it will set off a voltage comparator and start the thing beeping like crazy. You know what I'm talking about, okay? There's more radiation in one of those smoke detectors than there would be in a room full. You know, I mean like a living room full of the radium ore that John had. This was not metallic radium we're talking about. This was a little tiny piece that between the size of a nickel and the size of a quarter of radium ore. Okay? And all it had to do was go to like 2 to 3 times level in order to make sure that the dosimeter was working in the lowest setting. This was not something that could be possibly used to harm someone in any way, shape, or form.
Right. Let's just back up, if we could, Joe, to this whole business of Joseph Mazzucchelli allegedly being an undercover Mossad agent or someone at least with extensive or at least significant ties to the Mossad, and I'm not sure what other intelligence outlets, but John himself alleges that He was, in fact, a CIA asset for a number of years. I think it was during his university days, and it all ties into the KGB, and, I mean, it just gets weirder as it's weirder and weirder as things go on. So, but Joseph Massachusetts and the Mossad.
No. Joseph Massachusetts had nothing to do with the Mossad. I believe he was instructed to lead Joe down that road by whoever was involved in this, whoever the intermediary was. I think they were holding something over him. He never discussed it. I would have liked to have had him on the show. We've had him on several of the, at least one of the shows. I don't know about several, but at least one of the shows on the other network. And, I mean, I caught him in many lies. He's basically, you know, he has some level of psychopathy. He can stare at you and tell you a lie as if it were the truth. And you would be prone to believe it because of the way he presents it and how he builds it up. I don't believe, and John no longer believes, by the way, that Joe was ever involved with the Mossad, any kind of intelligence gathering, you know, or anything like that.
He did with the interview back in 2013. He called Bill Burns from Future Theater Radio, and it wasn't the other way around. Bill calling John. It was John somehow managed to get through to Bill, and at various 20-minute intervals, because that's all he's allowed, on the phone from the, I guess, the Mid-Hudson Psychiatric Forensic Institute. That's all they grant their patients, or these 20-minute intervals in speaking to the outside world. But at that point, he did claim, he did think and was under the impression that Massicelli was some sort of Mossad-type asset, and that there are, in fact, 25, allegedly claimed that there is something like 25 Mossad agents protecting him, protecting John Ford, and there is this gunfight that broke out a few hundred yards behind his house, and go into that a little more, if you would, to flesh things out. And then we got to circle back around to this whole thing regarding the fire, because with the South Haven Park fire and the UFO crash, that's where you get really the corruption allegedly emerging, the way they tried not only from the UFO end of things, trying to cover things up, the men in black and so forth, and there were supposedly a lot of black helicopters and black vans with black tinted windows seen in the region. You know, they shut down the roads there for a couple of days, I think, as I recall.
Oh, yeah.
But this, the business of the fires, they let the fires burn. They let the fires burn. And the Brookhaven Fire Department, I guess, is what it is. And they alleged, like, oh, no, we never were in attendance there or got called out or anything. But apparently they were called out. Whether they actually were on the scene or not, who knows. But who is it? Ed Decker? Who took over after the UFO magazine, after the Burns duo did?
I don't know. Bill Burns was on the show.
I'll check my notes here while you're doing that, though. This whole business of the gunfire, kind of the shootout, and these John being protected by the Mossad, and people, these shadowy kind of assassins that were sent to kill him. And what's the deal behind all this? This is really...
That's all part of the... That's a subplot in the story, okay? Joe had to be convincing. In fact, he brought him into the city to meet someone who is allegedly connected to the Mossad. I don't recall the gentleman's name, and I was only on the fringes of hearing about it. John didn't trust it all along. And, you know, the gunfight. I know that Massicelli was beaten. He was in John's car. He was using John's car. He was pulled over. He was beaten up. I don't know the actual reason.
Is that a fact, or is that just
that is a fact? Yes.
Okay.
No, that is a fact.
He borrowed John's truck to go where? What was he in the process of doing exactly?
John had several cars. He had an old Cadillac in really good shape. He had another vehicle, and he had his truck. And I'm not sure which one Massicelli was driving. He came back, and I don't know if he was being threatened by police, district attorney's office, political service, or whatever. But somehow they knew he was being in John's house. He was, you know, sleeping on the couch. We're talking about, you know, a suburban house, not in the boondocks, but between Brookhaven Labs and South Haven Park.
two of the places that you mentioned. I think he built that story up. John lived on the borderline of where they test fireworks. They have a testing field out behind there. John may have been half asleep, and Joe staged this for him, and it was in an effort to slowly build up his confidence. And Joe's basically a confidence man. He can convince you. Believe me, if you didn't know him and you sat down with him for a while, he can weave together a story, and you would believe it. Okay, anybody, any normal person, any reasonable person in a reasonable capacity would believe it after being exposed to it night and day for several months. You have to remember the guy, he's not working every day now. His mother just passed away. He's got Joe Masicelli living in the house because he broke up with his girlfriend or whatever the story was, eating his food, and then suddenly...
And stealing his guns.
Yeah, and then suddenly he steals his guns, and he's coming up with these stories that, I'm doing this for your kid, trying to protect you, that sort of thing. And the guns ultimately end up getting sold to someone.
Those guns were all legally, they were lawfully owned by John, too, correct? He had, like, licenses, and it was all done by the book.
He had a full carry permit. He was obligated to carry a gun.
Yeah, sure.
Everywhere he went. He was basically a police officer.
In the media, they really tried to play up the gun and kind of UFO nut, those two items in tandem. There's a number of Freeman magazines, I guess, or something like that, that were found on the premises. As far as I'm concerned, so what? I mean...
You have to understand something, Jeffy. John had literature of all kinds. He was interested in a lot of things. Wanted to know what was going on from both sides. He didn't trust mainstream media when it wasn't popular not to trust mainstream media.
So they're cherry picking. So the prosecution was cherry picking. It's like, we'll take these books out of his library and use these to kind of paint him in a less than flattering light, is what it seems. But hey, listen. Yeah, gotcha. So let's just give a quick shout out. We got a few people there listening live as we present today's show. A few technical problems from the get-go. Things seem to be rolling along quite nicely now, however, quite thankfully. So big shout out to Find the Truth, who's joined us here just for the first time today, as a matter of fact. So look forward to seeing more of this character, hopefully, over time. What they've said here is that they've been following George's story. John's story for over 2 months now, and first saw it on the Facebook page. So I think that would be the John Ford Initiative, which Richard Smith initially set up. Great resource, along with, let's not forget, the Elaine Douglas files. So, I mean, now that we mention her name, and we should also give a shout out to Mary Pia, who I think there is still lurking in the background somewhere as we present today's show. So, but I'm not sure where you want to go with this at the moment, whether or not we've really kind of gone into great enough depth and detail as far as the Mossad angle and the CIA business and the KGB. The KGB, that, I mean, John put together in 1997, he issued, I think it was like an 80-page press release or something, documents, handwritten notes that were intended for the media. They are archived now on the Elaine Douglas files over on ElaineDouglas.com, where actually, as I understand, Marilyn and Dick Carlson are actually have as good friends of Elaine, who sadly passed away in 2014 from, I think it was something like breast cancer. But let's not forget, is that right, breast cancer?
Yes.
Okay, but let's not forget, she was a targeted individual very much. She was very high profile. She'd been ousted from MUFON. And she had she had a few enemies, did she not?
Yes, she did. And she originally, when John first met her, I believe she was working for CNN or CNBC, something. I don't really recall, but she was working for one of the television news stations when they were actually delivering news to some extent, instead of being all political. She's a very well-respected journalist, and she's made a lot of enemies over the years. But, he did release, I believe, an 80-page document, handwritten. He also corresponded with Elaine Douglas.
He received letters and sent letters from the psychiatric facility and from when he was incarcerated down here on Long Island County Jail.
And they not only corresponded on a professional level, but I guess as things turned out, they maintained something of a romantic relationship over the years, too, something which you can, which Marilyn Carlson actually presented to us last time around, the show that we put together in June of 2016. So that is quite interesting that there was a romance that was sparked and kindling for how many years, I'm not sure exactly. A lot of passion, as one can see if they read over the letters and notes that were exchanged and sent back and forth via the two individuals.
Many of the details in those are redacted, but they really don't have anything to do with the case, the incident defense, or the staff now. If you'd like me to get to the very latest details, I can do that, because I think that deserves some note, because very recently, within the past 2 weeks, John has something called a treatment team, a group of psychiatrists and psychologists and nurses and so forth. They meet and they talk about him, and then they talk to him and they ask him questions, and they brought up something that was never divulged at the district attorney's office, who's still, by the way, in correspondence with the Mid-Hudson Psychiatric Center, that they had recordings, allegedly, of John telling Joe Mazzucchelli to take those guns and use them for some purpose, like for getting rid of one of the three, in specific, Anthony Gazzola, to be getting rid of him and put it in his fat belly and blow him away. But it turns out that after John requested a clarification on that, which he had to do legally, it had nothing to do with him. It was Joe Mazzucchelli telling someone else a story, someone that worked for the district attorney's office, and that those two exculpatory evidence never turned over to those recordings. They never turned over to John's attorney, and he didn't even find out about it other than by accident in the past 2 weeks. Now, between November and now, he was supposed to go. We were literally on our way out the door to go testify for him when, for no reason at all. It was just they didn't give a reason. They just said, well, you're not going to have your trial today. And there were court watch people there. There were other attorneys. There were students. There were a lot of people who were very disappointed, okay, including John, obviously. No explanation was given for this other than that on the 30th of November of 2016, the district attorney's office they were allowed to ask for a second outside opinion besides members of the treatment team and employees of New York State to examine John independently on behalf of the prosecution. Now, John Bush had a very good report from another independent doctor we paid for. I sent a check to the lawyer and another one to the doctor. This was to be an independent report. They had their chance to ask for another external outside opinion and pay for it. They didn't. It was supposed to proceed further later on in February. That was adjourned until April. And in April, they suddenly requested additional time to prepare testimony of three doctors. They hired three doctors. Now, in some states, that's considered fraud. That's considered phishing, okay? It's been established, not in New York State, but in other states. If you get an outside doctor and you don't like his opinion, you can't just go hire two more and another one gives you the same opinion. You get a third one. You can't do that.
Kind of like what they're doing with the Brexit now, and they do with all these referendums. The people, the vox populi, the people, the voice of the people speaks loud and clearly. The elite 1% ruling class, it doesn't jive with them. Yeah. So it's like, well, let's try that again. Well, we don't really think so. It's not really the outcome we're looking for. We'll try that again.
We'll have elections and modifications to the law until we win, until we operate our own government. I mean, it's basically the same thing. But on, you know, on a much smaller scale. Now, obviously they can't let John be released and completely vanquished because he could sue them potentially for billions of dollars. Now, they let the time expire, the window of time where John's attorney could prosecute this case, and even if it was not found in John's favor, he could appeal it, okay? And that was all paid for. The doctor's testimony, good or bad, was paid for in advance. The lawyer was paid for. The court cost, legal fees, everything, and nothing happened. And John now has to wait another 2 years before he gets any semblance of justice, before he can even approach a court again.
And even, apparently, even if the ruling does go in his favor, he'll still be held in state custody for 5 to 6, maybe even 7 years after that. Is that not what I've heard? Is that not how the story goes? This is ridiculous. This is absurd. This is beyond absurd.
The gentleman is now 69 years old.
Well, okay? He's one of America's highest. I mean, that's the thing. He's a political prisoner. Now, why he's not more high profile, I don't know. That speaks a lot, though, to the state of what essentially is America at the present moment, and why more people are not rallying around this, his case and his cause. I have no idea.
I'll tell you something. He's now on his, I believe, his fifth administration, presidential administration. Let's see. He went in when, who was there?
Clinton. It would have been Clinton or Bush. And Bush, 43.
Bush.
Skull and bones.
Bush,
were.
Obama, and now, this is his fourth. This is his fourth president. John institutionalized, and I'm not even counting re-elections, but four different presidents. Okay, and it's not even at the federal level at this point. Now, it was originally a county matter, and it got elevated to a state matter, and he's basically awarded a state, and until he is able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty for all intents and purposes that he's not a threat to himself or others, they're not going to let him out of there. If they let him out of there, he has to admit that he came in with some type of disorder and he's leaving without the disorder. And he's not going to do that.
Well, has he not yet attempted to petition a jury? I believe that's one of the options that all people who are find themselves in state psychiatric care, they still maintain and hold that right to petition a jury. That's what James Heidrich has done. James Heidrich out in Coalingo, we interviewed him just a few weeks ago, another fascinating story where he as well could potentially, the way things look at least, be another political prisoner held under the guise of certain mental issues, when really it's just used as a pretext and a cover to keep their voices silenced. So, but what is business of petitioning a jury? Has that been attempted yet?
By the mental health laws of the state of New York, he's not allowed to petition a jury until he loses his request to put the mandatory retention order to have it set aside in the court just with him and his attorney and the judge and psychiatric testimony only. Okay? Once the judge says no, I'm going to believe whatever they rubber stamp your condition as. At that point, he's allowed to go ask for a jury trial so that the jury can be apprised of, and it's completely open to anything that's presented.
The judge knows this. The judges that have been sitting and presiding, they're fully aware. The Suffolk County, one of the most corrupt places in America from stories that I've heard, reports, people that have been informing me as to what the deal is there on the ground. Prosecution, state prosecutors are very, corrupt with all kinds of, as you might assume, ties to organized crime. When they say, when you have people like Robert Reno, who's characterized and presents himself as a criminal defense attorney, he's not kidding. He really is defending criminals.
Criminal justice. I think he's trying to walk a tightrope between his ability to earn a living in that court and to assist John in every possible way.
Well, to this point, all he's proven himself to be is a parent. Yeah, to this point, all he's proven himself, to this point, all he's really proven himself to be is a parasitical, blood-sucking ambulance chaser. That's putting it politely. So, but let me just go. We got some comments here. Things are heating up a little bit and kind of, got some people in the YouTube, the live streaming chat area that would like to have their voices heard. Of course, we do have the after show coming up here in about 15, maybe 20 minutes. Let's not forget. So that's another place where folks can join us in Skype. Find the Truth wants to say that there's got to be a way we can get John's story more out there. So, you know, she's basically supporting the idea and really advocating having more people learn about John's present and ongoing long-standing plight. Hero Motivators in the house and asking us whether or not John has tried the UN, the United Nations, contacting them and seeing if there is any recourse or maybe a sympathetic response from their end of things. Has he contacted the UN?
No, not the UN.
Amnesty International?
I've written to Amnesty International. I've called them local and national and international offices. I've never had a reply from them. Email, regular mail, telephone calls, or otherwise. I've tried many different sources, people that are allegedly. I did get to speak with one person who told me that this is a very, very narrow field of mental health law. You know, it was designed to be a, to have any type of reasonable legal remedy. In fact, you can't even be pardoned. I don't think a presidential pardon is even acceptable because it's up to the new religion, psychiatry, okay, the opinions of these doctors and alleged professionals.
They've done
the story.
Well, look, man, they've done the same thing for years in Stalin's Russia where people that were a thorn in the establishment side, you know, and political agitators, they were handled in very similar ways with the Soviet Stalinist approach and locked up, warehoused for years on end, many of them presumably dying and spending the rest of their lives in these state-run, I'm not sure what kind of care facilities, what the level of care they are. Substandard at best, I'd imagine. I'm not sure the food that they receive, what the quality of that is exactly. John is not, he's not being forcibly medicated anymore, but, you know, what about painkillers? He's got back issues. He's struggled with cancer. He's beat the cancer up to this point, from what I understand, but no painkillers.
Yeah. There's something that you should know about that as well. He was recently, just in the past week and a half, okay? He was scheduled to go for a colonoscopy because he did suffer from and was treated for, and it went into complete remission for colon cancer. He was operated on. I don't remember the year, but he has to go in every 2 years for colonoscopy where they knock you out and look around up there. So he was not allowed to make telephone calls or tell anyone or write to anyone, communicate with anyone, including his attorney, regarding the fact that he was going to be out off the grounds of Mid-Hudson Forensic Psychiatric Center. Prior to him going there, he was just the laxative and so forth to clear him out. I was getting worried. I didn't hear from him for about 3 or 4 days. And he usually calls me at least every other day, at least once a day. I didn't hear from him for about 4 days. I didn't hear from him until he actually got back from the hospital because they don't, even though they don't consider him a flight risk, they think that what we're doing is subversive, that his supporters may try to do something. Talk about paranoia. Okay? This is the level of paranoia that goes beyond imagining, where he's not allowed to contact even his attorney or anyone because he's going to be locked in a facility where they're going to examine him. He's going to be knocked out, examined, and then sent back. That's crazy. That, in and of itself, gives you some idea of the type of treatment he's been getting. He lived with a horrible, horrible back pain. And they gave him some type of medication to help him sleep for stomach ulcer or something, which was not a psychiatric medication per se. It was more of an antihistamine. And one of the side effects was that it
promotes weight gain, and he was up to over 300 pounds.
Wow.
350 pounds, I believe, at one point. And that was after the operation for cancer. So he survived cancer, and he survived being in there. They limited the number of possessions he can have. He doesn't have enough room to store all of his clothing. I have some of his stuff in storage unit, everything from his house, which is, by the way, sold in a storage unit. And I have some of his possessions in the hospital, and in my basement. So he's being denied some basic human rights, and the right to contact your attorney or your power of attorney. Now, granted, I'm not an attorney, but I have to deal with things. You know, I have to write checks to people. I have to maintain contact with people on a daily basis. I have to get the word out. I have to speak with Richard. He operates the website where money's donations are collected for his legal funds. The legal fees are horrendous. A 10-minute phone call to his lawyer costs $45.
Yeah, well, this Robert Reno guy, if it was me, forget about it. You know, you're better off without any lawyer at all, period, obviously. What a joke. Total fiasco. Daniel Sheehan, I guess, has been contacted via Marilyn Carlson. She said that last year she did speak to him at one of the, I think it was Contact in the Desert, and now crickets. I don't know. Has he got back to her at all?
No.
Crickets.
There's no return from any of the heavy hitters, either him or Marty Tankliff, the guy who was convicted of a crime when he was 17, released, got a law degree. He's in high demand because he understands the problems behind this sort of thing.
So he's got to get pro bono. I mean, I don't know why this route hasn't been attempted up until this point. It's kind of a no-brainer to me, at least. If I was a lawyer, I would do everything within my power to promote the case and give it as high a profile and exposure as possible. Let's go back, though, to this whole business of the state and how it is that they, I think, really are concerned, and probably some people in fear. A couple have passed away. The former DA, Catterson, who I like to refer to as Catterwall, because it kind of just makes sense, you know, and John Powell, now both deceased from what I understand. But there's got to be remnants. There's got to be people that are connected somehow, of course, too, and that do stand to really lose out in a big way if they are further exposed. Not only that, there would be a considerable payout if he was eventually released and able to actually hold the bastards accountable. That it would, we're talking a multi-million dollar payout. In fact, Robert Reno, you know, he really, as once again, pumping up, building up John's confidence, had, according to Richard Smith, billed it as the trial of the century, is what he told, John. And then the next day with the trial of the century, what happened? Robert Reno's a no-show, along with the two psychiatric assessors.
With no notice to John, by the way. John was completely in the dark.
And that's why he's paying all the money, the big money, you see. That's why just they're bleeding them dry, right?
Well, I'm signing those checks. That's one of my jobs. I sign the checks. I write as POA, and I mail the check out. Transfer money from one account to another. Hey, and I know how much he spent on various attorneys. We had a professor of law at Touro College file something one day late by fax when they had changed the law where you can't file a motion for appeal. She filed it like 5 minutes late, 5 minutes after midnight, or something to that effect. And they had just changed the law, and she wasn't aware of it.
Well, you're saying that the law, the state law, was changed just prior to... How does that back up, and does this go over that one more time?
He had an attorney. She was very professional. She was being subsidized by, I believe, A&E Network and Sweezy, who was involved in the Montauk Project.
A&E Network. Now we're talking heavy hitters then.
It was at the time that this was going on. It was owned by Hearst Publishing, and I worked for Hearst Publishing. But as soon as they found out, he was in the psychiatric center. They put the kibosh on it, and that was the end of it. We had to start paying her, and
at the time that it came to file for the jury trial. It came in 5 minutes late. It came in by fax, and they had passed the law into effect that January. I believe it was in February. She didn't know about it, because she had been filing papers like that as a matter of course for other clients as well as for John. You know, she apologized, so she didn't give any of the money back, but that's okay.
But Joe, how did this new law that passed in January impact and affect John's case?
Well, it went into effect in January, and when he was denied relief, and you know, by the judge, they had a certain number of days. I think, I don't know if it was 30 days or 20 days, whatever, to file for a jury trial. You have to go in front of the judge first. He denied, and you can file for a jury trial in the mental health area. In fact, it's called mental health court. So she filed, actually a specialist in this, okay? She filed 5 minutes late, making it 1 day late, and she filed by fax, which was no longer acceptable, okay? So that was thrown out, and John had to wait another 2 years. And in the interim...
Joe, she's a specialist in this area, and you think, and you're quite certain and confident that it was all just a mistake, that she filed 5 minutes late and just it didn't quite make it through, and he had to wait another 2 years, thanks to the specialist snafu oversight.
I'm telling you, the political machine in Suffolk County, they will go to no low depth. You can imagine they'll go lower, okay? They don't want the information out. They accused your radio show in particular last year when someone made a joke about going after someone, which was basically meant in a legal sense, that it was a threat against the doctors who worked on his case.
Anything you idiots, so wake up. And like, these people are sociopaths, okay, period. All right, it's institutional sociopathy. There is the psychopathic end of things that comes into the picture as well, let's not forget. So to hell with them, like, you know. So what was the details on this exactly then? Who made the comment? What was it exactly? We're going to go after them. Like, what?
I listened to the show, and I listened to the after show, and I know my voice wasn't coming in through very, very well. It wasn't me. I think it was something that Captain Sinclair said.
You're talking about the captain? The captain? He's a character. Yeah. The captain's quite the character.
Or Larry.
Oh, God. The captain got under their skin.
Yeah. Let's make her watch the game.
He's a show character, man.
I couldn't believe it. John told me this. It was written up. That's really the only thing that's in his report against him. Is that he has followers on the outside. And we all pose a significant threat to them. Okay, and now I'm being treated that way. Okay, I live in Suffolk County. I live dead center, just about. I have death threats, code enforcement. If my grass is a half an inch too high, if my car has 1 foot parked on the lawn.
Well, it's like Carolyn Rose Goyt has been talking about these city ordinances. So let's get, I think we've got the captain. In fact, he's been listening to the show attentively, as he typically does. Captain Sinclair, you are there. I believe you've heard these comments. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you, Taffy, this is all just a load of nonsense. I can't believe how thin-skinned these people can be.
Well, that's kind of right, Captain. So I think what a lot of us are thinking as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is just incredible. These people call themselves professionals with integrity. I mean, that's just clearly a total lack of integrity and ethics. I'm not sure. And especially, they can't take a little bit of a joke. You gotta wonder what's going on there. You can tell they're really getting under the skin. And maybe that's good. Maybe that shows that we're making a little bit of an impact on the pirate ship out of the Robin Hood.
Well said, Captain. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to things?
No, I think that's about it. And it's not John Ford, really. It should be free. It's just I can't believe. So maybe we will stage something with a pirate excursion and poking around and taking a little further look into things and see what steps can be taken to help Mr. Ford. This really needs to be made a higher profile.
I think I agree, and I think, I think most people listening here today agree. So thank you, Captain, for dropping in. So he's up there on the quarterdeck, kind of keeping a watch out over things as he typically does through the course of the show. So, wow, how about that? So, isn't that something? Isn't that something? I think I smell a new blog on the way. You know, I think I smell a new blog. You know, so yes.
Jackie, I just want you to know this, and I want everybody that's listening to know this too. If you have any even doubt in your mind, just because he's in the loony bin and he's been there for so long, at minimum, go back and see the news coverage around his case, which was, I'm sorry I was wrong about the date, it was June 12th. June 12th, it'll be 21 years. The warrant was dated for the 14th. We have a copy of the warrant. So on June 12th, it was Tuesday night, the house was surrounded by police. There was a police informant inside. They beat his dogs. They handcuffed John. They beat him. They did the same to Mazzucchelli. He was out. He got out of the house, and they pushed him over a railing, broke his glasses, handcuffed him. They made 57 minutes of recording of just banter back and forth between Joe Mazzucchelli and the informant. With John Barrow's word.
Yeah, for the record, who was this informant? And let's not forget, this tape was doctored. You've got recordings of this tape, I believe, do you not? But it was also, doctored.
Yeah. The principal basis of it was two recordings, phone recordings, between made that were right before the entry to, initiated by the district attorney's office, by the people working the case, one of whom was in the house at night. He was presented to Joe by the guy who he saw John, one of John's guests, as a close friend.
Are those the audio files that you've got up on the Elaine Douglas website?
They're on the Richard Smith website. There are two of them.
Well, but they were talking about that asshole John or something like that. What were those recordings?
That asshole John. At the very end of the last conversation. Now, John asked me to monitor cellular communication because he was allowing Joe Mazzucchelli to use his phone exclusively. And he didn't know what was going on. So using the electronic serial number and my proximity to the tower, I was able to monitor any calls that went out from the phone, as soon as they hit any tower, and any calls going into that phone. I was able to monitor them automatically and store them digitally, along with the time code, so that when you press the button, you can actually hear a tone, starts the clock running. So there's a time code in there, encrypted on a set. Now, their recording was done onto a reel-to-reel tape recorder, which was then transferred to cassette for the purposes of giving one to the court, one copy to the defense, and one copy to the prosecution. It was also used to get the warrant in the first place, because on the 12th, they had those calls, and the calls ran until, I think, 8:22 p.m. What was actually said was something about the informant who was at the house, who ultimately went to the house that same night, a little before 9, and recorded for about an hour before the police broke in and so forth. He was discussing stuff with Joe Mazzucchelli. Mazzucchelli was telling him that John has this extra hot radium or whatever to bring a blanket, to bring gloves, bring goggles, bring a Geiger count, kind of stuff. And if that's a
incarceration here. And we have lost Joe Emanon, a.k.a. Joseph. You're cutting out there. Big.
Can you miss me?
Well, no, you're back now, but let's see if we can finish this show off with a bang. So let's hope the prosecutors there in Suffolk County don't take that the wrong way. They can, I suppose, spin it any way they like, but let's just let them put it in their pipe and smoke it. How about that? You know,
this is what we're up against. They manufactured evidence. They took a piece of something that Mazzucchelli was talking about, a totally different subject, and they patched it into the conversation to make it sound like John was plotting on killing these people, and it was because of UFOs. Okay? And that was not the context of the conversation. Those things were never said. Okay.
A total cut and paste job to set him up and frame him. That's really what it was.
Exactly. I can pick out the spot in the tape where it was cut diagonally. tape back together and then only issue them cassette to the proper parties, the court, the prosecution, and the defense. Okay? But they couldn't, with the original recording, they could not get a warrant for John. Because this has nothing to do with John. This has to do with John Powell, who was running an illegal toxic waste dump, a chop shop, and was abusing morphine. And he was sent to prison, federal prison. This is a matter of record. I'm not going to put myself on the line and say something that isn't true. You can look this up. Okay? He went to prison. Okay? Towell, the other guy, Fred Towell in Suffolk County, who was overseeing this stuff, having work crews go out there digging place for Grumman to get rid of radioactive and toxic waste. He was charged in 2002-2003 with a federal crime involving bribery and corruption. He flipped on his friends, okay, and right around the same time, John Powell was given a heart attack.
The digitalis solution for Mr. Powell's home, it sounds
attack,
like.
Yes. A 52-year-old man in good health wakes up dead, okay?
So these
first time.
You know, and they let it slip. If you look at these cable television news reports, the recordings that you have archived there, the news reporter he's grinning, he's smirking, he's laughing. You know, he thinks the whole thing's really quite hilarious, and he actually let it slip that Powell was the head of the conspiracy. You know, and then he backed up and he retracted the comment and, oh, just a little slip of the tongue there. But isn't that something? So was Powell, in fact, the tip of the spear there to this whole thing?
Yes, he was getting the main benefit. And John was snooping around at the crash site, at the alleged crash site, which was widely reported, not just by Long Islanders, but by, the satellite data.
Joe, did they not let those fires burn? Because I guess the idea there was like, oh, geez, like, let it go. Like, we can really cash in here with real estate now. Let's get some real estate.
They did actually cash in. Now, that was from a different event, but it was basically the same thing. John was into that as well.
There were two crashes, were there not? Were there not two UFO crashes? What's the deal there?
Yes, two separate incidents. John was investigating first. And can you just press...
Sounds like you got a call coming in there from somewhere. Or
no,
someone.
No, no. Sir, it was a timer. It was a timer. But that's okay.
We've got, and speaking of which, you know, we've about reached the time here. In fact, we've overshot things a little bit here as well. Don Ecker was the guy's name. I remember earlier in the show, I was trying to remember who it was that said to be in possession, according to Bill Burns. According to John Ford, who spoke to Bill Burns back in 2013, Ecker is the gentleman in possession of photos and video of the South Haven UFO crash, which includes fire crews and even, you know, body bags, and I'm not sure if alien bodies as evidence can be seen as well, but I think I have seen footage at one point or another, and it's kind of blurry and shaky, but there's a lot of activity there on the ground and a lot of commotion for sure. Burns could not understand why Ecker had not made these videos and photos more public, so he's found that immediately struck him as quite odd and puzzling, but Preston Nichols, though, too, just kind of running.
History Channel, Jaffe.
They were
on the History Channel and on I believe, Science Channel at least once, along with several of the people who are with the Long Island UFO Network. Not to be confused with Mutual UFO Network, who have been completely non-supportive of John.
And unaffiliated as well, too, correct?
Unaffiliated, they basically saw themselves as competitors. John got on the scene first. He wouldn't share the information because people could speak with John and he could keep this stuff confidential. He wouldn't let out the names of doctors, lawyers, people that had a lot to lose by reporting a UFO. He wouldn't let their information free. And MUFON wanted that. So when John fell on hard times and was being set up, they did nothing. They didn't even issue a statement one way or the other. And to this day, they haven't done anything. The only people I've been able to talk to at MUFON are Isaac Coy in Europe, but in the United States, and some of the lower level, the investigative teams and so forth, who I'm still in contact with.
Really?
But as far as the polls of MUFON, some of their own people are saying they've been infiltrated by some one or another intelligence agency. This is what I'm being told by members of MUFON, who I'm not going to identify, obviously. Lower-level members who have very good support for John, have always been assistants. We've shown mutual cooperation and so forth as far as sharing equipment, resources. But on a higher level, MUFON is in lockdown, and they will not issue a statement or a report John 21 years after the fact.
Isaac Coy, so he's a decent person to talk to, do you figure?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what about, I've seen him around, actually. I've just been trying to work on getting a kind of a read on the guy, essentially. So I've seen that he's been active over on the Free John Ford Initiative and whatnot. So and we do have a number of friends in common via Facebook. So it'd be interesting to see whether or not he actually gets engaged over on Minds.com eventually. We'll have to play that one by ear, though. What is the name of the psychiatrist? I know that there's a few psychiatrists that John has had to deal with. But one of the most recent ones, though, I think, that was around the time of this criminal, I guess, as the defense lawyer, Catherine Williams. I don't know if she was, like, on the prosecution end of the equation or what exactly. But the psychiatrist...
To be honest with you, Kathy, I don't want to mention any doctors in specific other than the doctor that John retained. Dr. Greff. It's spelled grief, but...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's the name that I'm looking for, because you talk about, yeah, there's a lot to be said for people's names from time to time, and that's one, but there has been a lot of grief. There's been a lot of grief with John's case, and so it's no surprise, then, I guess, that no coincidence that he should end up with this psychiatrist of the same name, you know, bearing a whole world of grief. So that's pretty sad.
He was hired by me and by the attorney to examine him. He's examined John, I believe, a total of three times. Extensive interviews with John, originally with the attorney that was being paid for in part by A&E and Stuart Squeeze's organization. They fell involved in the Montauk Project thing. And when they backed out of it, we had to pay her basically in full. And then she messed up. She got the doctor, you know, to present an alternative, okay, without bringing up the incident defense, because at the time, 20 years hadn't passed, and I couldn't go forward with this information because I was basically monitoring John's private communications, his cellular phone, and I could have put myself in jeopardy of being arrested for interfering with an investigation, wiretapping, or, you know, whatever, you know. Even though I was doing it wirelessly, you're still not supposed to be able to break those terms.
Joe, there's a couple issues we got to address here before we wrap up, and we do have to just kind of go over these as quickly as possible. Time is really of the essence here. We've gone far over the typical 90-minute allotment that we put together each week. This is, of course, a very critical case that is worth the investment, though, however. But we do got to, let's just see if we can quickly run over these issues and talking points. Preston Nichols, where is he? Is he passed away? Is he still around? Montauk?
He's ill.
He's not doing so well. Yeah.
He lives in Cairo, New York now. He lives in seclusion. He's got a degenerative illness, and he is not going to be of any assistance to John
right.
in his condition right now.
Right. He was a longtime friend.
Yes. In fact, he was one of the few people that actually went on News 12 and spoke in John's defense as best he could. And for his trouble, he was given a head injury involved in a one-car accident. All sorts of, he was basically driven out of Suffolk County just for speaking up on behalf of John.
Well, how about that? Just more of these coincidence sort of theories, stacking up. The coincidences adding up, and the more that you see them piling up, the more that I know I can't help but think it's just a big stinking pile of bullshit. So that's really unfortunate to see that these people end up being targeted individuals simply for taking a stand, showing the backbone and courage to stand by your friends, knowing that they are innocent, in the face of the lies and deceit on the part of the powers that be. So one or two quick little other talking points that was hoping you'd be able to address. Unfortunately, once again, Marilyn Carlson off on a Alaskan cruise, which good for her, bad for us. She really had a lot to offer last time around. So, as well as, of course, I'm not sure Kelly Freeman, if he's listening in today or not. Richard Smith, not able to make it. He's busy with work. Peter Moon, unfortunately, a no-show. That's really too bad, as he was a real wealth of knowledge. Ken Storch didn't end up getting back to you. So we've managed to carry on here and forge ahead and put together something, hopefully, that people will be able to glean certain key talking points and pieces of information, which really help to kind of clarify things as complicated and strange the twist that this case takes. It's kind of, you really do have to take some time to look into things and get a clear sense of what's actually going on. So here's one of the last things. This third suspect, Zeebo, the wild-eyed Grumman employee with grenades, supposedly. How does he tie into things, and where is he? Is he, what's the latest on him?
Now, he's charged with possession of an unregistered handgun. He was given a 6-month suspended sentence. It was mandatory in New York State. He wasn't carrying it or anything. It was no conspiracy, obviously. The only person that was actually convicted of conspiracy was Joseph Mazzucchelli, who served 6 years of a 12-year sentence. Zeebo was ultimately convicted for possession of a handgun that was unregistered, which had nothing to do with John and nothing to do with the case. They thought that, well, they wanted the public to think that he was in on it because he had access to radioactive materials. Meanwhile, the county and the local government in Brookhaven, or Crookhaven, they were being paid to cart stuff away and bury it in toxic waste dumps. No one else was even brought up on charges.
Well, Brookhaven's rolling things here, though, Joe.
This is a conspiracy between the district attorney's office and Joe Mazzucchelli, with John as a target. That was it.
Well, John Powell, too, let's not forget.
Well, John Powell instituted, the district attorney's office executed it. The guy that was running the investigation is now the town code enforcement chief of Smithtown, where I live.
This isn't Towell. Okay. Towell, what's the latest on him? I know you talked.
Fred Towell was convicted of a felony. Hello?
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you. Okay, I'm sorry. I lost the receive signal for a second. Towell was convicted of a felony in 2003 and turned in a lot of his friends. Powell was convicted in several years after John was sent away. He was convicted of all sorts of things, including toxic waste, running a chop shop, abusing prescription painkillers, you know, selling them, buying them. He was put away, and Anthony Gazzola died in December of 2015, I believe.
Gazzola being who exactly?
He was the code enforcement chief for the town of Brookhaven. And he was the guy that, he was originally a cop in Brooklyn, and he ran one of those operations that I saw in a movie where they take criminals and give them a ride in a police car to their destination from the airport. He was kicked off the police force. Well, he was basically told he can resign. This was in the late 50s or early 60s. He came out to Long Island, bought up a bunch of property, and he's been running things, sort of, so to speak, out here, basically like a crime family. He's passed away now. He got nothing but good obituaries in Newsday, which is owned, it's a local newspaper, and it's owned by the politicians, as is News 12, where much of the televised information came from on an hourly basis. That was the top story. From June 12th until the downing of Flight 800, that was the top story every hour.
Isn't that interesting, too, the timing of Flight 800 that suddenly captured all of the news viewers' attention? And it was alleged, too, there's some sort of Brookhaven tie-in to this, supposedly, with a laser, allegedly. Some people seeing something being shot from that area into the sky and hitting the plane. Is that not the case?
No, they actually saw missiles being fired. The contrail of missiles and the streaks of missiles exploding, one of them so close to the wing that it snapped the wing off.
Was it from Montauk? Is that from the Montauk areas where these missiles?
No, it was a little bit
was not quite Tumanto. It was about 12, 14 miles west of Montauk. It hadn't reached Montauk yet, but it was between where John lived and Montauk, about halfway between.
Brookhaven is the last really key point and area that we should hit on here and get into just for like 2 minutes at the most, really. But isn't it interesting to note how during Catterson's presentation and media circus that Brookhaven analysts and experts were in attendance? They really were quite straightforward, I think, and balanced with, you know, an objective presentation and explanation of what radium actually is and that it's largely harmless. Really? You know, unless okay. Some ridiculous dose, of course. But isn't it interesting they brought them in that tie-in with Brooker, as you put it, Crookhaven? And in the context of these UFO crashes in particular, because it's really of all this coming together, essentially, with the political corruption, the UFO crashes, the whole thing, the illegal radioactive dumping, and there's John Ford walking right into the middle of this huge hornet's nest, and here's what he ends up having to deal with.
Well, it's commonly called Crookhaven. Everybody involved in this lived in Brookhaven. You have Grumman, the Grumman facility where they tested the F-14s, x-rayed them for body stress using radium isotopes, actually metallic radium, okay, to expose x-ray film. And then the alleged five canisters of less than a gram of radium were put into John's car. In front of a news reporter, he opened his car, which is unlocked, and parked in the street, and put them there before they went in his house in case they couldn't find anything in his house, which they didn't find anything in his house.
There's your top-notch kind of quality journalism in play. So, holy
jeez. They sold them putting the stuff in the car and then taking it out. And when the guy asked, what are you doing, they told him to back up and get behind the line.
The news reporter? Is that they told the news reporter this?
No, they told the guy who was taking video of it. They were actually putting these things in John's truck.
They had them out. There would have been then video of this occurring then, correct?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
That's right. They told me he had video of them putting it in John's truck, in the back of John's truck.
Where is that video now?
It wasn't listed on the warrant. Okay, the truck was parked on a public road in front of John's house. It was unlocked, and that's what they charged him with, possession of that material, which came from Grumman. And these guys were all sitting in the head saying, where it came from, could have come from the doctor's office. Like hell, okay? Excuse me, but like hell.
Don't worry about the profanity or the salty language from time to time here. This is a pirate ship. So this is quite something, though. So this, I didn't realize this, that I was aware that the radium allegedly was planted in the vehicle, but it wasn't on the original illegal warrant, which only magically appeared 2 days after he was arrested. But even then, the radium was not included on this illegal warrant. It only, how long after the illegal warrant did the radium suddenly come into the picture?
They didn't touch any of the other cars. They went directly to the truck, opened the back of the truck, and asked the camera guy to come over and take pictures.
Oh, jeez.
Okay?
Oh, God.
You can see it in the video. And they specifically asked in a press conference less than 13 hours after John's arrest. A press conference was convened. They specifically asked, was there any radium in the house? No. Where did you find the radium? Was it in the truck? And the guy was from News 12. Yeah, it was in the truck. And he goes on to something else. Well, look at all these rifles. I asked John about the rifles and the handguns. He says, yeah, the handguns are mine. Every one of them is registered. And yes, I had ammunition, but a lot of those rifles weren't mine. Weapons possession or anything like that. He wasn't charged with that. He was obligated to carry a handgun, in fact. He went to work for 22 years. Every day he went to work, he carried a handgun and he was in uniform. So we're talking about a guy who's, you know, votes Republican. You know, he's very skeptical. He just saw a need for a reporting facility because the cops would just laugh at the UFO things, or they would make a public record like they just recently did and get these people looking crazy on television, whereas John kept things quiet. Not that I'm aware of.
And as far as this business, the alleged stakeout of, I guess it was Republican Powell's, his political title, what sort of office did he hold exactly as head of the Republican Party for Suffolk County?
Yes, he still remained head of the Republican Party even after he was convicted of a federal felony, racketeering.
Oh, my God.
Okay? But he was still head of the Republican Party, and his children were put into high office as well.
They're still alive, I imagine, so maybe, you know, they perhaps feel that they have something to lose, perhaps by Mr. Ford being, you know, sprung from the hell that he's having to live, and like I said, once again, hold the bastards accountable. What's the deal with the stakeout then? Is this, I kind of pressed you on this behind the scenes, just kind of in the lead up to things today, just a short while ago. You claimed that there's nothing to it. The official line is that he was in a vehicle staking out Powell's residence for 2 days with a, well, this large military type automatic rifle. What's the reality to things?
I can truly state categorically, I would take a lie detector test this, that John Ford didn't even know what town John Powell lived in. What neighborhood or what town. I guess he knew he lived in Brookhaven, but he didn't know the street address. He didn't have, and he had no concern for Powell. He was casually asked, what do you think of him? Oh, he's a rat bastard. He's no good. He's dirty. You know, that was John's typical response. Except for that cursing. The thing of it is, they actually went on record saying that he and Mazzucchelli in a car staked out in front of Powell's house with a high power rifle, and that they were listening to their conversation in the car. I mean, why didn't they arrest him? They had a good chance to arrest him there. What are you doing sitting with a high power rifle when you made threats against this guy? But no. Because John isn't there. It's as simple as that. He doesn't still say they know where John Powell lived.
Yeah, that is kind of a pretty obvious question. Is he's out there staking him out for a couple days with a high-powered rifle. Why did they not arrest him exactly? A little odd. Leaves you scratching your head. So I think that is about it, Joe. I'm really grateful to you for having been a part of things today. Once again, it's unfortunate nobody from last year's roundtable was able to make it, but I think, you know, you've had more than enough opportunity here to share with listeners as many of the particulars and key details and points that we could come up with here today. So hopefully manage to interest a few more people in the case. I think it's about time we made our way perhaps out for a little bit of fresh air. The Howling Wolf Inn sometimes gets a little wild and raucous. But looking forward to talking to you in the after show. I'm not sure. There's, of course, a few website links that we've got to share with people here. The Free John Ford Initiative on Facebook. What about Richard Smith has a couple web pages? What else can you think of besides that and the Elaine Douglas files?
The primary website that people should go to start with when you get this information is johnford.ufoteacher.com. That's Richard Smith's website for the John Ford Initiative. And there are the recordings, there are links to the Elaine Douglas files, to the News 12 reporting, to John's letters, to the transcript of every court appearance that John made. And there's also a link to Inception Radio Network, which has downloadable free with no exchange cookies. Your identity won't be given away. If you live on Long Island and you're worried about that, you can go to Inception Radio Network and there are at least 20 or 21 shows that run about between 90 minutes and 2 hours. Of a discussion group every month regarding details on John Ford with a detailed background and updates from month to month exactly what's been going on. And there's going to be another one this Sunday.
Very good. Excellent. Sounds great. Thank you once again. All the best to not only you, but of course, John, as hopefully he'll get a chance to listen to this at one point or another in some form or another. Big thanks to Find the Truth, Mary Pia, Hero Motivators, and Everyday Psych Victims Project, along with everyone else that tuned in to today's show. So until we meet again on the High Digital Seas, I'm your host as always, Jaffe Ryder.
There we be. Having carefully looked over each of our navigation panel instruments,
checking every level, switch, knob, and dial.
By all accounts and indications, we indeed see it's time once again to drop anchor inside the bay and draw an end to another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. Don't forget, if you're looking for a little more free-flowing action, we've likely got another great Rogues Gallery After Show coming up next in either Google Hangouts or Skype. Also, if you've in any way enjoyed or found yourself benefiting from the shows we've tirelessly produced over the past 16 or so odd months, you might want to drop by our new Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. Missouri-based podcaster and fellow Minds.com personality Innerverse recently decided to take a chance on throwing us a bone. Along with virtual Buccaneers Kelly Freeman and Carol Sloan, that now brings our official number of patrons up to 3. Presently commanding a whole 6 big ones per episode, our impeachable longshoreman math skills tell us we're on course this year to set aside around $150 in charity. Help to keep those numbers growing over on Patreon, and we'll be able to extend even more of a generous pirate hand. Coming up next week, same time as always, flying rainbow lasagna mystic and spiritual adventurer, the lovely Aurora. Penciled in for what promises to be a total day of discord, June 23rd, Minds.com's Satori D will be joining us to discuss the Infinite Imaginarium Project and more. South American-based ayahuasca and shaman experts Peter Gorman and Alan Shoemaker will be rounding things out on the night of the 30th for what is promising to be an all-too-trippy month of June. If you yourself have an intriguing idea for a guest or story, you can either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or fire us a quick email via PirateOneRadio@gmail.com. WPRPN.com network subdomain links are also now available. Great for artists, musicians, podcasters, social media personalities, or pretty much just any landlubber looking to boost their online visibility, presence, and reach. Basic accounts can be launched for only $15 a year. Staking your claim now helps not only strengthen you and the network, we're also looking out for the little guy. That's right, folks. Half of all WPRPN's profits are redirected right back into the hands of the people who really need it most. Community charity. After all, we are the Robin Hood. You can further embark on your own personal pirate journey by liking, subscribing, commenting on, sharing, and following any of our main social media channels via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google+, or Minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tally-ho!